This is Audible.
Audio Renaissance presents Opening the Eye of New Awareness by His Holiness the Dalai Lama, read by Ken MacLeod.
Our program begins with this preface for the text, an introduction written in 1999 by the book's translator, Donald S. Lopez, Jr. The first edition of this translation of Opening the Eye of New Awareness in Tibetan, Losar Mikje, was published in 1985 under the title The Opening of the Wisdom Eye. Translated by a team of Buddhist monks from Tibet, India, and Great Britain, The Opening of the Wisdom Eye is a general paraphrase of the Tibetan, with long passages, absent in the original, interpolated into the text. It also does not include the author's citation of Indian sources. For these reasons, a new translation was called for. For this second edition, I have provided a new introduction, which discusses the importance of opening the eye of new awareness and places it within the larger context of Tibetan Buddhist literature. In 1962, the Dalai Lama published his first book, My Land and My People, an autobiography that brought the story of the Chinese invasion and occupation of Tibet to an international audience. The next year, 1963, he published in Tibetan his first work on Buddhist thought and practice, Opening the Eye of New Awareness. Unlike most of his subsequent publications, this work is not an edited transcript of public lectures, but rather is His Holiness's own summation of Buddhist doctrine. Completed just 4 years after his escape from Tibet, and 4 years after completing his religious education, it is a work of consummate scholarship by a 27-year-old geisha. Tibetan Buddhist texts traditionally begin with a promise by the author to compose the text, considered essential for the work's successful completion. Such a promise is also found in Opening the Eye of New Awareness, where the Dalai Lama writes, "Therefore, in accordance with the merit of those beings who do not have the leisure to study the great texts, profound and full of impact, I write this Opening the Eye of New Awareness, a treatise of few words, primarily for easy comprehension, expanding the illumination of the wisdom that thoroughly differentiates phenomena." Unquote. Much is implied in this brief statement. First, His Holiness identifies his audience as those beings who do not have the leisure to study the great texts. There are several famous genres of Tibetan Buddhist literature similarly devoted to summarizing a larger corpus of works. There are the stages of the teaching, or Tenrim texts, which set out the Bodhisattva path from the awakening of Bodhicitta to the achievement of Buddhahood. There are the more famous stages of the path, or Lamrim texts, organized around the practices of the three persons, those who seek a better rebirth, those who seek liberation from rebirth for themselves alone, and those who seek liberation from rebirth for all beings in the universe. Although both of these genres may make mention of tantric practice, the focus of these works is the sutra, or exoteric path. A separate genre, called preparatory manuals, is devoted to the preliminary instructions for tantric practice. The stages of the teaching and the stages of the path genres are generally expository in style, providing descriptions of samsara, discussions of the workings of karma, and techniques for developing bodhicitta, each supported by citations from Indian and Tibetan classics, interspersed with exhortations to put the teachings into practice. A separate, though related genre, called mind training, or lojong, is devoted to more direct and practical instructions for developing and sustaining bodhicitta, often conveyed in a less scholastic style. While all of these genres are devoted to the Buddhist path, another important genre of doxography provides summaries of the positions of the various systems of Buddhist philosophy. Some works in this category also discuss the non-Buddhist schools of Indian thought, while others contain expositions of the sects of Tibetan Buddhism, including Bon. Some also describe the schools of Chinese Buddhism. Thus, there are many works of Tibetan Buddhist literature that are intended for, as the Dalai Lama states, those beings who do not have the leisure to study the great texts, profound and full of impact. Yet opening the eye of new awareness does not fall easily into any of these standard genres. It is important to recall that the book was written in the first years of exile, a period of profound crisis for the Dalai Lama and the Tibetan refugees fleeing across the Himalayas. Hence the phrase, those beings who do not have the leisure to study the great texts, means something more in 1963 than it did prior to 1959, where it could have appeared as a stock phrase at the beginning of any number of Tibetan texts. The Dalai Lama, perhaps, had a different audience in mind. The term new awareness can also mean those with new awareness, or beginners. Quite different from the beginner's mind of Zen fame, here new awareness connotes a mind yet untrained in Buddhist thought and practice, yet containing great potential, an eye that has not yet opened to see things as they truly are. His Holiness thus describes his book as a treatise of few words, primarily for easy comprehension, expanding the illumination of the wisdom that thoroughly differentiates phenomena. Indeed, opening the eye of new awareness is devoted much more to wisdom, especially the wisdom arising from hearing the Dharma, than it is to instructions for practice. One does not find the detailed descriptions of the six places of rebirth that would occur in a Lamrim stages of the teaching text. One does not find the instructions on the exchange of self and other that would occur in a Lojong mind training text. The Dalai Lama is writing a different kind of book and for a different audience. Everything that he sets forth in this work would be common knowledge for a Tibetan Buddhist monk trained in the scholastic curriculum of any of the sects of Tibetan Buddhism. But in 1963, those monks were living under the most difficult conditions upon their arrival in India, some living in former British prisoner of war camps and ravaged by tuberculosis. For such monks, deprived of their great libraries, opening the eye of new awareness, in which the erudition of their young Dalai Lama is so brilliantly displayed, could serve as an inspiring aid to their memories. But the Dalai Lama certainly had at least two other audiences in mind. The first were Tibetan lay people, especially young people, an audience for whom works were rarely written in Tibet. For this group, who certainly lacked the leisure to study the great texts, the Dalai Lama composed a clear and concise summary of Buddhist doctrine. And in 1963, the Dalai Lama must have had yet another audience in mind, the growing number of readers in the West who had an interest in Tibetan Buddhism, but whose previous exposure to the tradition had been fraught with magic and mystery. The Dalai Lama is thus concerned in opening the eye of new awareness to present Tibetan Buddhism to the world as a tradition that holds its rightful place in the heritage of Indian Buddhist thought, a heritage of reasoned analysis and systematic practice. At the same time, opening the eye of new awareness must be seen as the work of a consummate scholar of Buddhist thought and practice. It is clearly the work of a monk who has completed the monastic curriculum, and, indeed, the Dalai Lama had completed his academic training just 4 years before, standing for the Geshe examination in 1959. His studies had been delayed by the difficulties of that decade, a series of crises that required his constant attention. Even during this period, however, the Dalai Lama did not neglect his studies, having his two tutors accompany him on his visit to China in 1954. He debated with the leading Gelug scholars of the day during the New Year celebrations of 1959, just a few weeks before his escape to India. Those who were present recall the breadth and depth of the learning of one who bore the plight of the nation on his young shoulders. Opening the Eye of New Awareness is a clear demonstration of that learning, and many of the Dalai Lama's discussions are drawn directly from the text he had so recently committed to memory. Space does not afford an opportunity to provide a detailed analysis of his sources. However, a brief description of the Geshe curriculum may prove useful. The formal curriculum entailed the study of five main texts. The first was The Ornament of Realization, attributed to Maitreyanatha, which delineates the various Hinayana and Mahayana paths to enlightenment. It is highly detailed, employing the famed 8 subjects and 70 topics to reveal the so-called hidden teaching of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. After completing the study of this text, the curriculum moved next to Chandrakirti's Entrance to the Middle Way, which is regarded as a supplement to Nagarjuna's famous Fundamental Treatise on the Middle Way, in that it provides the religious context to Nagarjuna's exposition of emptiness. Chandrakirti's text is divided into 10 chapters, each devoted to setting forth how the understanding of emptiness is to be integrated with the practice of one of the 10 perfections, virtues cultivated by bodhisattvas on a 10-stage path to enlightenment. Over half of Chandrakirti's text is devoted to the 6th perfection, wisdom. This long discussion of the seminal topics of Madhyamaka philosophy, including emptiness, the two truths, a critique of the Yogacara, and proofs for the selflessness of persons and other phenomena, is regarded by the Gelugs as the locus classicus of Prasangika Madhyamaka. Throughout the long course of study, there was time taken each year, often in the form of a communal retreat from the monastery, for logic and epistemology, represented by Dharmakirti's commentary to Dignaga's Compendium on Valid Knowledge. This text contains arguments for the existence of rebirth, liberation from rebirth, and the omniscience of a Buddha, discussions of the two valid sources of knowledge, which are direct perception and inference, classifications of proof statements, and an analysis of the operations of thought. Written in a cryptic, poetic style, this is considered one of the most difficult Indian shastras, and is thus especially loved by Geshes. The Dalai Lama's proof for the existence of rebirth, maintaining a strict dualism between mind and matter, relies on Dharmakirti. Since matter cannot produce consciousness, consciousness must arise from a previous moment of consciousness. Because a prior moment of consciousness must be posited as the cause of the first moment of consciousness at the time of conception, the existence of rebirth is established. The fourth text in the curriculum was the Discourse on Monastic Discipline by Gunaprabha, which is the source of the myriad rules and regulations governing monastic life. The vows of monks and nuns, discussed by the Dalai Lama, are created in great detail in Gunaprabha's text. The final work in the curriculum is The Treasury of Knowledge by Vasubandhu, a compendium of Hinayana tenets dealing with all the major categories of Hinayana doctrine, encompassing philosophy, soteriology, and cosmology. The Dalai Lama's discussion of karma comes from Vasubandhu. One topic that is not covered in the Geluk scholastic curriculum is Tantra, and the Dalai Lama provides a very brief discussion, focusing on the reasons why the secret mantra vehicle is superior to the perfection vehicle path. Here he draws from the first section of Tsongkhapa's great exposition of the stages of mantra. Beyond this very general and cursory treatment, he is reluctant to write more, explaining that the details of the Tantra path should be taught in secret to suitable disciples who have received the appropriate initiation. In his words, it is not suitable that they be proclaimed in the marketplace. In subsequent years, the Dalai Lama concluded that it was preferable to have the tantric path set forth clearly, rather than have it remain subject to misconceptions, and thus has allowed the translation and publication of some of his tantric teachings, especially those connected with the Kala Chakra initiation. Opening the Eye of New Awareness concludes with a brief discussion of the history of Tibetan Buddhism and an enumeration of its major sects. Such a chapter would not commonly occur in the works on the stages of the path or in doxographies of Buddhist doctrine, but would instead be found in histories of the doctrine. The Dalai Lama seems to have two audiences in mind here. For the Tibetan audience, he stresses the authenticity of each of the four major sects of Tibetan Buddhism, showing how each is an unbroken lineage of teaching from India. Using the example of different types of airplane that are all capable of flying to the same destination, he goes on to argue that each of the four sects is capable of leading students to the goal of Buddhahood. In this way, he takes a stand against the sectarianism that had been so common in Tibet, and that he has sought to counter in exile. For the Western audience, he counters the claim that Tibetan Buddhism is Lamaism, a form of Buddhism so remote from the Buddhism of India that it does not deserve the name. To demonstrate that Tibetan Buddhism is, in fact, an authentic form of Buddhism, he recalls the close contacts between Indian teachers and Tibetan disciples during the first and second disseminations of the Dharma, and he notes the authority that Indian texts hold in Tibet. To quote him, "Any Tibetan Buddhist who has even the slightest need to remove a qualm about a point of doctrine, or who needs a source, will do so on the basis of sources in the statements of the Buddha or an Indian scholar adept." Unquote. In sum, Opening the Eye of New Awareness is a remarkable work, providing a compendium of Buddhist doctrine and practice that is both dense and rich, serving at once as a summation of knowledge and as an invitation to further study. Nowhere in his many subsequent works does one find a more clear and concise exposition of the essentials of Buddhist thought. Indeed, all of His Holiness's many publications are in some sense commentaries on this first book. An Overview of Tibetan Buddhism. We begin now by repeating a lecture delivered by His Holiness the Dalai Lama at the Zen Center in Green Gulch, California in October 1979. In a large hall, the meditators chanted the Heart Sutra, after which the Dalai Lama said, "Dharma friends, I am truly happy to sit with you in meditation, and to be here while you chant the Heart Sutra in the Japanese manner, since we Tibetans also frequently recite this scripture. Over lunch, Baker Roshi explained to me your practice. It is very different, very far from ours, but that degree of difference shows the richness and variety of Buddhism. As much as the systems appeared to be different, so much greater did my respect for Buddhism grow as I listened to him. While there are different philosophies and different methods, all have the same motivation: compassion, love, kindness, tolerance, and self-discipline, and all have the ultimate goal of Buddhahood in order to help all sentient beings. Kindness or compassion is the basis of Buddhism. Usually we speak of lesser and great vehicles, but I prefer the terms vehicle of hearers and vehicle of bodhisattvas. In the vehicle of hearers, the main essence is not to harm others. The whole vehicle is contained within the union of calm abiding, shamatha, and special insight, vipassana, with ethics as their basis. Non-violence, or not harming others, is the root. Thus, compassion, karuna, is the basic teaching in the vehicle of hearers. In the bodhisattva vehicle, the essence is to serve others, to help others. Compassion has become more mature. The practice of compassion at the beginning, when your capacities to help others are still not developed, is not to harm others. But then, when those capacities have developed, it is to go to others to help them. Thus, in both cases, the basic teaching is compassion. There is no question that compassion and kindness are important for those who practice religion. However, even for those who do not, these attitudes are extremely important. Even in a materialistic society, compassion and love are the basis of happiness. Whether you believe in a future life or not, whether you believe in the Buddha or not, whether you believe in the Bodhisattva path or not, love and kindness are beneficial even in worldly life. Also, love, compassion, and kindness are common to all religions: Christianity, Hinduism, Islam, Judaism, Sikhism, and so forth. Their value is clear for all, believers and non-believers. In Buddhism, there are many explanations of techniques for developing, training in, and implementing compassion. From this viewpoint, Buddhism is very useful to society these days, particularly when there is danger of the human problems of war, unrest, violence, and terrorism. Under these circumstances, the force of compassion, the force of love and kindness, is essential. For any activity related with human society, compassion and love are vital, whether one is a politician, businessman, communist, scientist, engineer, or whatever. If such people carry out their professional work with a good motivation, that work becomes an instrument for human benefit. On the other hand, if people work at their profession out of selfishness or anger, the profession becomes distorted. Instead of bringing benefit for humankind, the knowledge gained in the profession brings disaster. So compassion is essential. May all here practice it. Now I will say a little about Tibetan Buddhism in general, by way of the three trainings: ethics, meditative stabilization, and wisdom. In the scriptures of the hearer vehicle, the training in ethics is comprised of avoiding harming others. In the Bodhisattva scriptures, the training in ethics is based on restraining selfishness. In the Tantric system, the practice of ethics is centered around restraining ordinary appearance and conceptions of ordinariness, although the terminology differs from that explained earlier to me by your abbot. The overall meaning is the same. With respect to meditative stabilization, samadhi, the process of achieving it is described in the scriptures of the hearers, and even though in the Bodhisattva scriptures a great variety of meditative stabilizations are presented, the nature of the process is the same. However, in the tantric systems, the mode of achieving meditative stabilization becomes more profound. The Tibetan word for concentration, samten, has the same meaning as zen. To describe briefly how concentration is achieved in meditation, first of all, there is an object of observation that is either an external object or the mind itself. In the latter case, when the mind itself is taken as the object of observation, the practice is more profound. In terms of posture, sit in either the full or half cross-legged posture with the hands in the position of meditative equipoise, the left hand below the right and the two thumbs touching, making a triangle the base of which is about 4 finger widths below the navel. The cushion should be such that your rear is higher, the effect being that no matter how much meditative stabilization you cultivate, you do not become tired. The backbone is to be as straight as an arrow. The neck is to be bent just a little downward. Aim your eyes over the nose to the front. Attach the tongue to the roof of the mouth. Leave your lips and teeth as usual. And leave your arms a little loose, not forcing them against the body. If your mind is involved with desire or hatred, it is necessary first to engage in a technique to loosen from it. Meditation on the inhalation and exhalation of the breath, up to a count of 21, is the prime means for doing so. Since the mind cannot have two modes of apprehension simultaneously, this meditation causes the former conceptuality to fade. Then it is necessary to form a virtuous motivation of compassion and altruism, wishing to help others. Conventional and ultimate modes of being of the mind are set forth. Here you are settling first the conventional status of the mind. For that, do not let your mind think about what has happened in the past, nor let it chase after things that might happen in the future. Rather, leave the mind vivid, without any constructions, just as it is. When you remain this way, you understand that the mind, like a mirror, is such that any object, any conception, is capable of appearing under certain circumstances, like reflections, and that the entity of the mind has a nature of mere luminosity and knowing, of mere experience. When you identify the nature of the mind as mere luminosity and knowing, hold on to that experience, the mere luminosity and knowingness, and stay with it. That is how to use the mind itself as an object of observation in the process of achieving meditative stabilization. If, rather than the mind, you use an external object of observation, such as the body of Manjushri, first take a good look at a well-designed image of Manjushri and visualize it mentally, causing an image of it to appear to the mind. Whether the object of observation is internal, the mind, or external, such as a Buddha's body, once you mentally locate it, the techniques are needed to cause the mind to remain vividly on that object. Since sound is the thorn preventing concentration, initially it is very important to stay in a quiet place such as this meditation center. Also, both stability and clarity are needed with respect to the object. What prevents stability is the mind's scattering or excitement. When the mind does not stay on the object but becomes distracted, scattered, or excited, there is a coarse version of excitement in which the object of observation is lost. But there are also subtler forms in which, even if the object of observation is not lost, a corner of the mind is thinking about something else. You need to identify such scattering and excitement and, through mindfulness, not let the mind come under their influence. The initial obstacle to clarity is lethargy, a heaviness of mind and body. Lethargy also can serve as a cause of laxity, which also prevents clarity. Again, there are two types of laxity, coarse and subtle. In coarse laxity, the mind sinks, and the object of observation fades and is lost. In subtle laxity, even if the object is not lost, the clarity of the object and the clarity of the mind diminish. Once the mind's intensity has weakened, the mind becomes too loose. As an antidote to becoming scattered or excited, you need to lower the mode of apprehension of the mind. Similarly, when you have laxity, it is necessary to heighten the mode of apprehension. A moderate mode of apprehension of the mind is needed, lowering or loosening it when there is danger of excitement, and heightening it when there is danger of laxity. Thus, the force behind developing meditative stabilization is mindfulness, holding on to and not allowing distraction from an object with which you have become familiar. What supports this process is introspection that inspects from time to time to see whether laxity or excitement have arisen. It is said that when one is able to sustain the object of observation through mindfulness and introspection, and when one has the concordant circumstances of good merit and so forth, it is possible to achieve meditative stabilization within 6 months. As you develop meditative stabilization, your mind passes through 9 stages. In brief, initially you must forcibly apply the mind to the object of observation with great exertion. Then you intermittently engage the object with less exertion. Then you engage it without interruption in a more relaxed manner. Finally, you stay on the object without any need to apply the antidotes to laxity and excitement. This should occur spontaneously. If you are able to stay for 4 hours vividly and continuously on the object of observation without exertion, you have achieved the factor of firm stability of mind. Unfavorable conditions of body and mind that would make them unserviceable in a virtuous direction are removed, in that the winds or energies that support body and mind are removed, and a bliss of physical and mental pliancy in which body and mind are serviceable in virtue is attained. At that point, you have achieved the meditative stabilization of calm abiding. Although this type of meditative stabilization is indispensable for achieving the higher paths of Buddhism, it is not unique to Buddhism, but is shared with Hindu and other non-Buddhist systems. In the non-Buddhist Forder systems, one actualizes this meditative stabilization of calm abiding called the not unable, which is a preparation for the first concentration. Then, through 6 mental contemplations, one achieves the first concentration, the second, third, and fourth, and then the 4 formless absorptions of limitless space, limitless consciousness, nothingness, and the peak of cyclic existence, levels of increasingly subtle meditative stabilization. However, in the Buddhist systems of Sutra, and especially of Tantra, it is explained that it is sufficient to achieve just this not unable mental contemplation, which is a preparation for the first concentration, the higher levels of concentration not being necessary. What is the purpose in achieving such meditative stabilization? It is not just for the sake of gaining a mind of a higher level, such as the first concentration, where one temporarily suppresses the manifest coarse afflictions through viewing the lower level as gross and the higher level as peaceful. It is not just for the sake of proceeding in the manner of a mundane path. Rather, the purpose of meditative stabilization is to serve as a basis for achieving the supramundane special insight that realizes selflessness, through which the afflictions can be removed completely and forever. To generate the wisdom that realizes selflessness in your continuum, it is necessary first to realize the meaning of emptiness, or selflessness. Whereas meditating on faith means that faith is cultivated by causing the mind to be generated as a faith consciousness, meditating on selflessness means to take selflessness or emptiness as an object of meditation, as the object of the mode of apprehension of your mind. To do that, it is necessary to know what selflessness or emptiness is. As is clear in Nagarjuna's fundamental treatise on the Middle Way, phenomena are not said to be empty because they are unable to perform functions. Rather, all phenomena are empty because they are dependent arisings. From this, it can be understood that the meaning of emptiness and the meaning of dependent arising are one and the same. Since things are dependent arisings, are dependently established, there is nothing that is established independently. Dependent and independent are explicitly mutually exclusive. Thus, once things are dependently established, they are definitely not independent. Independence, or non-dependence on others, establishment under the object's own power, is called self. Because it does not exist, we speak of selflessness. According to the consequence school, which embodies Nagarjuna's thought exactly as it is, there are 2 types of selflessness, of persons and of other phenomena. There is no difference between these 2 types in terms of the quality of the selflessness. The only difference is the substrata. To ascertain the meaning of selflessness, in general, you must engage in analytical meditation. That is, you must analyze it with reason and reflection. This is why, in Nagarjuna's fundamental treatise on the Middle Way, many reasonings are presented, all for the sake of proving from many viewpoints that all phenomena are empty of being established under their own power. All phenomena are empty of inherent existence. The Pile of Jewels Sutra says, in the context of presenting the three doors of liberation, that forms are not empty because of emptiness. Forms themselves are empty. Therefore, emptiness does not mean that a phenomenon is empty of being some other object, but that it is empty of its own inherent existence. Thus, it is not an other emptiness, but a self-emptiness, in that objects are empty of their own intrinsic establishment. Similarly, the Heart Sutra says, form is emptiness, emptiness is form. Taking form as an example, that form is emptiness means that the final nature of forms is their natural voidness of inherent existence. Because forms are dependent arisings, they are empty of an independent, self-powered entity. Emptiness as form means that this natural voidness of inherent existence makes possible the forms that are its sport, or are established from it in dependence upon conditions. Since forms are phenomena that are empty of true establishment, since forms are the bases of emptiness, emptiness is form. Forms appear as reflections of emptiness. This final nature of forms is their absence of not depending on other factors. Forms themselves are not their own final nature, but are empty of being their own final nature. Thus, forms are the sport of emptiness. It is like the two sides of a coin. On the one side, there is the emptiness of inherent existence, the final nature. And on the other side, there is the appearance that is the substratum of emptiness. They are one entity. Therefore, form is emptiness, and emptiness is form. Contemplating the meaning of emptiness in this way, you gradually make progress over the paths. The progression is indicated in the mantra in the Heart Sutra. Om Gate Gate Paragate Parasamgati Bodhisvaha, which means, proceed, proceed, proceed beyond, thoroughly proceed beyond, be founded in enlightenment. The first proceed refers to the path of accumulation, the second to the path of preparation. Over these two periods, you ascertain emptiness in the manner of dualistic appearance of the wisdom consciousness and the emptiness being realized. Proceed beyond indicates passing beyond the mundane level to the supramundane level of the path of seeing, in which dualistic appearance has vanished. Thoroughly proceed beyond refers to the path of meditation, during which you familiarize yourself again and again with the emptiness that was first directly seen on the path of seeing. Through it, you finally pass beyond cyclic existence to the level of enlightenment, bodhi, a state of being a source of help and happiness for all sentient beings. This is a brief explanation of emptiness, the object with respect to which a practitioner first develops the wisdom arising from hearing, then ascertains with the wisdom arising from thinking, and finally, in dependence upon meditation on it, proceeds over the stages of the path. The above has been an explanation of the three trainings of ethics, meditative stabilizations, and wisdoms in the sutra system. In highest yoga tantra, meditation on emptiness is done mainly by way of stabilizing meditation, rather than with analytical meditation. In connection with this, there are many techniques involving focusing on important places in the body, the four or six channel centers, the chakras, and so forth. In this way, a system of practice is explained in which one person simultaneously practices all three vehicles, externally abiding in the discipline of individual liberation, internally practicing the altruistic intention to become enlightened, and secretly supplementing these with secret mantra or tantra. This is a brief explanation of the situation in Tibetan Buddhism. I have great admiration for your system of practice too. When we strive for inner development, great achievement is very difficult, almost impossible within a short period. So when beginning to practice, we should not expect too much. With a mental attitude of patience and strong determination, as time passes year by year, inner progress will develop. As one Tibetan Lama said, suddenly looking at it, it may seem as if it is impossible for someone like oneself to be able to do these things. However, compounded phenomena do not remain as they are. They change with conditions. If you do not become discouraged and keep working at it, something that you think could not be produced in 100 years is one day produced. Therefore, for us who supposedly practice these things, willpower and determination are essential. Also, while we practice inner development, daily conduct according to moral principles is very important for the benefit of both ourselves and society. If we, who are supposed to be practicing Buddhist doctrines of kindness and so forth, lead a good and reasonable life, it is a demonstration, an example for others, to help them realize the value of Buddhism. People who pretend to practice a system, but whose conduct and way of life are not good and reasonable, not only accumulate non-virtue themselves, but also harm the teaching in general. Therefore, it is important to be conscientious. This is my appeal. Thank you. I have been very happy here. As you were ringing the bell this morning, I had a sense of being at my own monastery in Tibet. I was very, very happy remembering the same time in Tibet, when it was still dark before dawn, and the bell was ringing, feeling a little sleepy. With these words, the Dalai Lama concluded his talk. Now let us turn to the text, Losar Mitje, Opening the Eye of New Awareness. Chapter 1, The Need for Religious Practice. Homage to the final exalted wisdom that thoroughly differentiates phenomena. At this time of the 20th century, an era of chemicals and weaponry, during the phase of ethics among the 10 periods of 500 years in the teaching of the fourth leader, the teacher Shakyamuni Buddha, external material culture is continuing to develop and expand. At the same time, there is a vital need for similar development and expansion of inner awareness and attitude. In the Buddhist way, internal culture is achieved through thought and meditation, and for that it is necessary to know how to think and how to meditate. Therefore, in accordance with the merit of those beings who do not have the leisure to study the great texts, profound and full of impact, I write this Opening the Eye of New Awareness, a treatise of few words, primarily for easy comprehension, to expand the illumination of the wisdom that thoroughly differentiates phenomena. All beings are equal, in that they want happiness and do not want suffering. This does not apply merely to us humans of higher intelligence. All, even dumb and obscure creatures, from the tiniest insect on up, only want happiness and do not want even a little suffering. Therefore, everyone, ourselves and others, must find a method to cause happiness to arise and to keep suffering from arising. Without such a method, it is impossible for happiness to arise and for suffering to be eliminated merely by waiting with a great hope, "How nice it would be if I had happiness and did not have suffering." Consequently, we must establish the causes from which happiness arises and abandon the bases of the arising of suffering. The means for establishing the causes of benefit and happiness and for abandoning harm and suffering cannot be gained by any other way as fully and completely as through religious practice. Through religious practice, we are able to bring about happiness and alleviate suffering in this and many future lifetimes. This life, the next life, the life after that, and so forth. Even in the case of this lifetime, Nothing surpasses religious practice for bringing about happiness and abandoning suffering. For example, in cases of physical illness, there is a very great difference between those who have and those who have not understood the essential meaning of religion in terms of the degree of their mental and physical suffering and their ability to alleviate that suffering. A person who has not understood the essentials of religious practice and who does not have any of the ambrosia of the magnificent impact of such practice has, in addition to strong feelings of physical sickness, the great suffering of not being able mentally to bear that illness. He or she is troubled by both physical and mental suffering with no opportunity for happiness. However, if a person has understood the essential points of religious practice, he or she voluntarily accepts suffering with the thought, for example, that it is the fruit of ill deeds accumulated in the past, and, seeing that suffering is the nature of cyclic existence, wishes to take responsibility for previous actions. As a result, mental suffering does not arise, and because it does not arise, the power of internal thought is able to suppress the external pain and suffering of the physical sickness. The reason for this is that between body and mind, the mind controls the body, so to speak, and the body is as if under the control of the mind. Therefore, mental feelings of pleasure and pain are stronger than those of the body. Similarly, some people who desire the happiness of riches accumulate and guard their wealth, incurring great physical and mental fatigue. They suffer initially from the inability to amass as much wealth as they had hoped for. Even after gaining some wealth, they suffer in the meantime from the inability to stop it from being stolen by others, being lost or destroyed, being squandered and the like. In the end, they suffer, because no matter what they do, their wealth becomes the property of others, and they themselves must part from it forever. All such sufferings related to wealth and resources result from not having understood the essential topics of religious practice. When they are understood, one sees that all wealth is as essenceless as the dew on the tip of a blade of grass, which evaporates quickly at dawn. Consequently, one does not undergo any of the sufferings that are associated with the wearying accumulation and guarding of wealth, and the suffering of being separated from it against one's wish. In the same way, when unpleasant words of abuse, blame, slander, and so forth are spoken by others about oneself, there arises a suffering like being pierced in the heart with a thorn. However, if we understand the essential topics of religious practice, then we see that all of these are essenceless like an echo, and even slight suffering does not arise, as if mindless matter had been abused. Similarly, in this lifetime, the suffering of not subduing enemies, the suffering of not keeping friends, the suffering of others winning and oneself losing, the suffering from terrifying warfare and mutual hostility between nations, which destroys the happiness of countless beings, in short, all the hopes and fears based on gain and loss, happiness and unhappiness, all physical and mental pain whatsoever, are due either to not understanding religious practice or not putting it to use despite understanding it. If religion is understood and practiced, all this suffering can be eradicated. Why? All such sufferings arise only in dependence on such things as pride, miserliness, jealousy, and the three, desire, hatred, and obscuration. By pacifying and overcoming these faults, which are mainly mental, through the power of religious practice, one achieves knowledge of contentment as well as self-concern, concern for others' opinion of you, and conscientiousness. Body and mind remain constantly in pleasant tranquility, whereby unbearable suffering does not arise. Therefore, if we want happiness and pleasure in this life, and do not want suffering, it is very important to understand the essential topics of religion and then implement them in practice. Doing so, however, we should not be satisfied merely with happiness in this life. No matter how great the happiness of this life may be, it lasts only until death, not more than 100 years, since no one lives much longer than that. Future lives are journeys of greater length, and thus we must secure that long-range interest. We must work for the means of gaining happiness and alleviating suffering in future lifetimes. Furthermore, there is absolutely no way to achieve such happiness through techniques other than religious practice. Rebirth. Here, in the context of explaining the need to accomplish the purposes of future births, let us consider the opinions of certain people who do not know about the doctrine of rebirth, or who know a little about it, but do not fully comprehend the reasons for it. It might occur to them that the present mind depends exclusively on the body, and that because they do not directly witness former and future lifetimes, they do not exist. Their idea is that if something exists, it must be seen directly. Or they might think that the mind is produced in dependence on the body, that the body arises in dependence on the four great elements, earth, water, fire, and wind, and therefore that former lifetimes do not exist. They thus might conclude that at death the body turns into the four elements, and the mind turns into space, like a disappearing rainbow. Hence, they conclude that it cannot be said that there are subsequent lifetimes. Among those who think that mental awareness depends on the body, there are some who think that the mind is of the nature of the body, like beer and its capacity to intoxicate. Others think that mind is an effect of the body, like a lamp and its light. And still others think that mind is a quality of the body, like a wall and a mural on it. Thus, they basically think that a mind that was just produced in this life need not have been produced from an earlier mind of similar type, but rather is produced from mindless elements, which are of dissimilar type, as is the case, for example, with the power of intoxication from beer or fire from a magnifying glass. In other words, the arising of an effect that does not accord with its cause. Similarly, some mistaken logicians observe that there is no one who makes peas round, sharpens thorns, or colors the eyes of a peacock's feathers. They observe that there are uncharitable misers who become wealthy, murderers who live long lives, and so forth. And therefore they assert with bogus reasons that there is no such thing as the cause and effect of actions. Karma, carrying over from one lifetime to another. There are also some with meditative absorption who use clairvoyance to see that a person who was miserly in a former life is born into a wealthy home in the next life, and due to this assert that although there are former and later lives, there is no cause and effect of actions. Also, there are some who achieve a concentration or formless absorption through meditative stabilization, samadhi, and believe that they have achieved liberation, that is, moksha. When they fall from that state and see that they must again take rebirth, they conclude and assert that liberation does not exist. Though there are a variety of such assertions, former and later lifetimes do exist, and the reason is this. Even now, as adults, we remember states of mind from last year, the year before that, and so forth, back to childhood. Hence, it is established in our own direct experience that there existed a mind that was the earlier continuum of the present mind as an adult. In the same way, the beginning of consciousness in this life was also not produced without cause, nor was it produced by something permanent, nor was it produced from mindless matter. If it were, matter would be a substantial cause of dissimilar type. Hence, it definitely must have been produced from a substantial cause of similar type. With regard to how the type of effect is similar to the cause in this case, the mind of the new life itself is the sentience or awareness that is a type of luminosity and knowing. It is, therefore, preceded by similar luminosity and knowing. That former mind is not suitable to be anything but a mind produced in an earlier lifetime. Otherwise, if only the physical elements acted as the substantial cause of the mind, there would be faults, for example, corpses with consciousness, or consciousness that would be enhanced or deteriorate whenever the body was enhanced or deteriorated. Something suitable to become a mental entity is called the substantial cause of the mind. The physical body acts merely as a cooperative condition for the slight amplification or constriction of the mind. It in no way acts as the substantial cause of mind. Hence, there is utterly no such thing as non-mind becoming mind, or mind becoming non-mind. Regarding this, some who hold that transformation of non-mind into mind can occur attempt to prove the existence of such transformation with the example of the changes of certain external things, such as wood becoming fire, wood becoming stone in the form of petrified wood, and so forth. However, change in the formless mind is different from change in physical things, and there is no way that insentient matter can turn into formless sentience and awareness, just as, for example, something that is not space does not become space, and space itself does not become non-space. Hence, concerning the present physical body and non-physical mind, the body is established through the parent semen and blood, that is, ovum, acting as the substantial cause. But it is impossible for the parents' minds ever to act as the substantial cause of the mind. This is seen, for example, in the fact that intelligent and knowledgeable parents can have stupid children. No factor of the parent's body or mind becomes the mind of the child in this life. The actual fact is this. The mind that comes from the former life acts as the substantial cause of the mind of the present life, and the present parent's semen and blood serve as the substantial cause of the body. The relationship between those two, child and parents, is established by an action, that is, karma, from a former lifetime. Consequently, children and animals, and so forth, eat food and suckle as soon as they are born, without having to learn. This is due to the power of having become accustomed to eating food, being desirous, being hateful, and so forth, in their previous lifetimes. Their engagement in these activities is caused by the presence of earlier predispositions, vasana, in the mind. The Master Matricheta's Garland of Birth Stories says that one just born, its mind without strength, with senses dull, seeks breasts to suck and food to eat, untaught by anyone, is clearly due to being used to these in other lives.